Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. Today, I have a very special guest and author. He is Michael E. Sedgwick. Mike was born just before the outbreak of World War II in Hampshire, England, home of Jane Austen, one of his literary heroines. From the age of 4 in the early war years, he remembers spending many nights in a cold, damp backyard air raid shelter, listening to bombs falling all around as the German Luftwaffe tried to have destroyed Britain's most important naval dockyard in his hometown of Portsmouth. Those memories are contained in one of his short stories, The Shelter. At age 12, reading the romantic suspense novel My Cousin Rachel, it created a lifelong desire to write his own romantic suspense story. At age 15, he joined the Royal Air Force Cadet Program and qualified for a pilot's license before he was old enough to hold a driving license for his first car. During training, he experienced some hair-raising adventures, and that became the basis for another of his short stories, Tiger in the Fog. In his senior years at grammar school, his desire to write found an outlet in editing and publishing a literary journal. He was also an ardent biker and a participant in Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance while at college in London University. In 1961, he joined a multinational manufacturing company and spent 37 years in a technical capacity, living and working in Wales, Belgium, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, and the United States. His writing experience during those years was in the form of technical reports and international communications. Then in the 1980s, he began to write short stories, some of which were eventually published under the titles Of Heaven and Earth and Report from Mars. His early desire to write romance was finally satisfied during a 2005 return to Hampshire, England, when he visited Jane Austen's home. And this experience inspired him to write his first novel, Bramdeen, a late 18th century romance, which won first prize from Arizona Authors Association in 2010. His writing spanned a wide range of fictional subject matter, with novels focused on political intrigue, action, and romance, while his short stories cover humor, drama, murder, adventure, and horror. And after 54 years of married life, Mike and his wife now live in Tucson, Arizona, and he is a member of the Arizona Authors Association and of the Society of Southwestern Authors. And I am so pleased to bring him to you. So welcome to the network, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to speak to you.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you with us today because I'm so excited to learn more about you and your writing and your exciting background that you've obviously had. And I'm sure that gives you plenty to write about.
Yes. You mentioned visiting the home back in the mid-90s, visiting Jane Austen's home. And shortly after that, we stopped in this village of Bramdeen where there was a church which is 800 years old. And while the rest of my wife and my other friends with us were looking at tombstones to see if they could find a really old one, I was inside the church. And I sat on an ancient wooden pew thinking about the 30 generations or so of local inhabitants who had been baptized, married, and probably buried there. It seemed to me their ghosts just filled the small interior, and I could almost hear their prayers. This old church inspired me to write a short story, which then morphed into my first novel, which you already mentioned, Bramdeen, set in Hampshire in the late 1700s, which is the period that Jane Austen chose to write Pride and Prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see Jane Austen had some kind of very faint, hidden influence on
Absolutely, as did that church. I can just imagine sitting there and getting that feeling of the past and all of the people and their lives and what must have happened to them. It's kind of it's probably kind of an eerie feeling as well.
Yes, it was. It was. Yeah. And it compelled me to write something. I decided, well, I'd never written a book before, so I wanted to settle down and create one. And it's a romance between the young son of a local blacksmith and the beautiful daughter of a wealthy and status-seeking parent. And I called it Bramdeen after the name of the village where the old church is located. I attempted to reproduce dialogue somewhat in the style of the late 18th century. And I have Dr. Samuel Johnson's dictionary published in 1755, and I attempted to I made sure that every noun, verb, adjective, and adverb that I used in the book was also in Dr. Johnson's dictionary. I didn't want to introduce words that didn't exist in those days.
Oh my, what a project that must have been.
Well, it added some time to it.
Yes.
In the meantime, I'd been writing short stories through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I put together a couple of collections, as you've mentioned. One of them was Of Heaven and Earth, the 20 short stories. I get bored if I read short stories written by other authors where they're all on the same subject.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose to write about everything I could think of. The first story in the book is all about a discussion in heaven about the wisdom of the creation, whether it's a good idea or not. And the last story in the book is the very reverse. It's a medieval horror story called Satan Wears Red. And a little bit of everything in between there. Romance, horror, death, family life, a whole host of things, comedy. Try to make it interesting for anybody. It would be good bedtime reading because most of the stories take about 15 to 20 minutes to read.
Mm-hmm. And it also flexes your ability and your muscle as a writer and allows you to be quite diverse.
Well, some of the things were based on real life experiences, which I'm sure is true of most writers.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow that worked close to me, for example, who took part every year in a big fishing contest on Lake Michigan. And he was a good fisherman. He and his buddy were there for the whole week, and the day of the final day, they caught a huge fish. It's over 35 pounds of salmon trout. And they knew that was probably going to be the biggest fish of the week. And so rather than wait around, they decided to take off home, confident that they'd won a prize. Well, my friend all the way home was thinking about the prize, which was a $20,000 fishing boat that's fitted with every latest instrument, depth gauging, et cetera, et cetera. And he never thought about what he was going to give his wife, although he figured he'd buy her a microwave or something like that to satisfy her. But he got home, and as he opened the front door, he saw a card resting on the hall table, and he realized it was his entry coupon for the competition that he'd forgotten to mail. So he never did win the contest. And he talked about that for months. He just groaned and mumbled about that for days and weeks. And I thought that would be a good topic for a story. I put that one in there.
I love that. And is the short story The Shelter, is that also in Of Heaven and Earth?
The Shelter is in Of Heaven and Earth.
Yes. That just really, really got to me when I read that. I mean, here you are, a little four-year-old boy, and what it would feel like to experience nighttime in an air raid shelter. It sends chills up and down my body as I think about that. Maybe just give us a little conversation about that, and then that prompted you to write the story, The Shelter.
Well, it was, for me, a yucky experience because there was no proper door to the shelter, and it was full of spiders, which I've never been keen on, and all kinds of creepy crawlies in there during the night, and it was damp, being buried with earth and surrounded by bushes and shrubs, and I think other than that, I was probably happier than the adults who were with us because I was with my mother, and the next door neighbors used to climb over the short wall that lay between us, and they shared our air raid shelter in the backyard. And as the bombing grew closer, it was a tense situation, and I could understand the tenseness of it even then, but not so much as the adults did. You'd hear the bomb, a row of bombs coming slowly towards you, getting louder and louder, coming nearer, and then you'd get a very loud one, and you'd imagine the very next one could well land on top of you.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody holds their breath, and if it lands on the other side, you start to breathe again, but it means some other poor individual family has suffered.
Mm-hmm.
And my desire was to be outside looking up into the sky because there was a lot of action up there. Mm-hmm. You had the Luftwaffe bombers flying overhead. You had some British Air Force fighters attacking them. You also had a sky full of searchlights trying to pick them up. And when they picked them up, they would glitter like a little diamond in the sky. And then the anti-aircraft guns would pick on them and fire at them. And one time when I managed to sneak out of the door behind the neighbor who used to guard it with his life to stop anybody leaving, I managed to sneak out and saw one of the German bombers explode in a big cloud of flame and fall down. So it was an exciting time. And then in the morning, because this happened almost every night when I was 3 or 4, and in the morning we'd run out, like all the other boys in the neighborhood, looking for spent shells or anything that had fallen to the ground from all this activity.
Wow.
My greatest find was a small parachute about 48 inches from top to bottom, probably 36 inches in diameter, which was used by the Germans to drop incendiary bombs on the city.
Mm.
And the parachute had survived, and that was a great treasure that everybody wanted to try and take off me.
Mm-hmm. My, yeah, I would imagine the perception of a four-year-old, especially a little boy, would just think, wow, this is kind of cool. But boy, looking back on it, it's quite an experience that you and your family had to go through, and I think it probably helps to write about it, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It brought back memories when I started to write.
I'm sure.
It was the very first short story that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually in a writing class back in 1982. As soon as we got to the States from Europe, I joined a writing class. And we had a good time. We enjoyed each other. Even when the class was officially finished, we stayed together as a social group and continued checking each other's stories.
And you continue today with the Arizona writing groups as well. I think that's to have camaraderie and somebody else to bounce ideas off of, especially as a writer, which could be a lonely position sometimes. I think that helps.
Yes, I live in a retirement community of about 9,000 people most of the year. And we lose half the people in the summertime. They take off and go to other parts of the country. But there's a group of 6-7 of us that meet every month, and we review each other's work. And that's been a tremendous help, mm-hmm. getting feedback chapter by chapter. They've been reviewing the book I'm writing right now, which is called Time and Again. And that's been very helpful to get that immediate feedback mm-hmm. and suggestions for improvement or change.
For sure. So you're working on another book, Time and Again. Can you give us a little sneak peek?
Well, it's a quite a complicated book, really, which is gives ample scope for my friends to make corrections. Firstly, it's a book about Britain's internal security, MI5. You've got two bodies like that in the UK, MI5, which would be equivalent to the FBI, and then you've got MI6, which is the Secret Service, which would be like CIA in America. And it's about an MI5 agent who's been sent down to the southwest of the country in Wales, in fact, to a peninsula there where I, in fact, used to live for a while. And the suspicion is that drugs and heavy military-style weaponry, like missiles, are being landed there. So he goes down there to dig out what's going on and moves into a rented house. Falls in love almost immediately with an extremely attractive woman next door, married woman, by the way, living next door. And that distracts him from his job. He also runs into, I don't know how it would be best to describe it, putting it bluntly, he discovers a ghost in one of the caves on the very rocky coast. I imagine, I've never been there, but I imagine the coastline there would be somewhat similar to the northeast coast of New England territory, rocky areas with caves that are washed into the rock. And he finds a ghost there, and she looks very similar but younger to the woman that he finds so attractive next door. And that creates another problem for him. So there's three stories interwoven in this novel.
Well, we can look forward to that. When is the expected date?
I hope to get it finished by November.
Okay. All righty. We will take a look at that again around November. It's called Time and Again. Now, here's an intriguing title of one of your books. It's called The Boy Who Lost His Oomph. I love that title. Give us a give us an idea of what that's about.
Well, it's really a child's story. And I actually published it as a single short story. I don't think anybody has picked it up. It's the boy who wakes up in the morning and he feels extremely down. He's glum. He doesn't know why, but he feels that way. And his mother tries to cheer him, and it doesn't work. He talks to the dog. He talks to the cat out in the backyard. They don't have any way to help him. They look sympathetic, but that doesn't help him. He gets to school, and during the lunch break, he meets this young girl in the class, and she talks to him and tells him how much she likes him and what he does in class. And suddenly he wakes up to the fact that life is not so bad after all. He and the girl become great friends, and they both discover that they've lost their two front teeth, and that brings them together a little closer. So it's just a simple child story.
That sounds great. I love the title, The Boy Who Lost His Oomph. I think we can all relate to that. So now you have other books where you use the word and other tales. You have Second Time Around and Other Tales, An Unlucky Break and Other Tales, Philandering and Other Tales, A Cry from Mars and Other Tales. So these are all compendiums of short stories?
Yes, yes. I could read, if you were interested for 2 minutes, I could read a short excerpt from An Unlucky Break, which is probably my favorite story in the collection.
Oh, absolutely. That was going to be my next question. You got me. I was going to ask if you had a favorite. Yes, please do.
Okay, An Unlucky Break. There's a play on the title. Break as in car brakes, and break in terms of being luck, out of luck. Bill Stratton and I were two lucky men, both vice presidents at Mannering Aeronautics, with attractive wives, good jobs, and comfortable exclusive homes. We men and our wives became very close friends. I'm sure none of us could have foreseen the dramatic end to that friendship, and I'll tell you about it as best I can, based on what I know and what I've deduced. One autumn evening, as Alice and I were leaving our association clubhouse, I saw Bill with his wife, Laura. She and I had been introduced on a prior occasion, but we had never exchanged more than a couple of words. The Strattons were occupied with another couple, so I didn't like to interrupt them beyond swapping discreet waves with Bill. Laura, who at first never noticed me, was sitting on a bar stool. She was wearing a black sweater with a deep V-neck, a red miniskirt and matching boots with 4-inch heels. I've always admired good legs, and she had those without question. A cameo pendant drew attention to the ample space in the V-neck. I'm certain this display of her feminine charms was not deliberate, because she rearranged her skirt when she saw me studying her, although there was still a lot of leg to admire. Alice nudged me with her elbow. Behave yourself, Peter. You're starting to dribble. I couldn't stop thinking about Laura Stratton after we got home, and the image of her sitting on the bar stool wouldn't go away. I've long thought a fleeting and incidental sight of the human form can provoke a sexual response that lingers and grows, in time corroding the soul with an all-consuming desire for fulfillment. It may change the course of one's life, as that glimpse of Laura on a bar stool changed mine. The next time I saw her and Bill at the clubhouse, I felt compelled to introduce Alice. Hello, Bill. I'm so pleased to meet you here because I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Alice. Well, hello, Peter, Bill said. He stood and shook my wife's hand. What a pleasure to meet you, Alice. I've heard so much about you from Peter. This is my wife, Laura. Handshakes and pleasantries among the four of us followed. I made the opening move in cementing relationships. Seeing you both here a couple of weeks ago, we wondered if you played bridge and whether you would care for a game one evening. Laura was the one who responded. What a nice idea. Yes, we do play bridge, although not very well. We'd love a game. Let's arrange a date now. Her voice was deep and sultry, with a touch of that breathless characteristic that makes a woman sound sexy. This time she was wearing a red silk shirt with silver buttons. The top three buttons were undone, and the open space occupied with the same cameo pendant I had seen her wear before. She fingered the cameo as she spoke. "It's a shame we haven't thought of getting together in a social setting before now, but you may regret it when you've seen my bad bridge play." That's it. That's the exit play.
Oh, you're going to leave us there, huh?
Yes. Oh, no. I'm quite away.
Oh, no. Well, if that doesn't compel someone to want to know the rest of the story, I don't know what will. And that's an unlucky
bridge. Bridge develops, as you might guess from the opening, bridge develops into something more than bridge. So. And there's murder in it at the end.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for sharing that. That was excellent. I almost felt like I was there watching this. Well, now, as you write characters, where do they come from? Do you use any kind of questionnaire to help you get to know them better, or do they kind of develop themselves? Let's figure out how you go about character development.
A little bit of everything. Sometimes they're visually built on people I know, or a hybrid of various people I know. Sometimes the characters seem to develop once I get going. I found out talking to people at the Arizona Authors Association that I wasn't alone when I admitted one day that I often have writing a story or at least in writing a novel, while I have the beginning clear in my mind and the main characters and the ending, I fill in the middle as I go along. It sort of develops, mm-hmm. hopefully. And I discovered that a lot of people have the same problem, that they don't plan the book as they think they ought to. They start out that way, but they pretty soon leave their original plan and start moving off track a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I've even heard authors say that the characters begin to take on a life of their own and start heading in directions that maybe the author didn't have in mind, and then they just had to run with it.
That's true. That's certainly true with me.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you go about selecting the names of your characters?
They typically just come into my head. Almost the first name that comes into my head.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes later on, I'll look at it and think, "Well, I don't like that name," and then just another name will pop up. But names just come into my head. That's all I can say.
That's the name they were supposed to have. Now, do you write every day?
It goes in patches. Sometimes I'll write for 4 or 5 hours in a day, and then several days will go by when I've got to do other chores around the house.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have time to write. But this year, I've been writing this latest book, and I've probably written, by the time I think of all the corrections that I've made, I've probably written 400,000 or 500,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
It'll end up being a book of about 110,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
But I've rewritten sections a lot of times to make it more satisfying. And I spend a lot of time, when you ask me about names, I spend a lot of time thinking of the name of the attractive next-door neighbor that my protagonist called in London. wanted it to be just right. And the name of the ghost, which is a medieval kitchen maid who was killed in the 1500s. I had to think of a really attractive Welsh name for her. So those were names that didn't just pop into my head.
Mm-hmm. You had to give some thought to those. So at the end of the day, when you're done writing, do you feel energized or does it exhaust you?
Depends. Sometimes if I really feel that I've had some good ideas, I feel invigorated. But if I have to really work hard to try and make something come out, then I feel tired.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the next day I'll read the whole thing that I've spent several hours struggling with and think, well, that's no good, and I'll rewrite it all again in a different frame of mind.
Yes, that's so true. Sometimes it really helps just to put something down and come back with a fresh eyes the next day, and suddenly things become apparent that were hidden the day before.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if I wake up in the night, I'll get the idea then of what I want to
mm-hmm.
do. Some of my best ideas have been in the bathroom, I'm afraid.
I agree. Some of my best ideas are in the shower, so I get what you're saying. It's when you're not supposed to be thinking about it is when it hits, which is okay. Whenever the muse strikes. So as you've written all of these books, what have you learned about yourself?
I think probably that I'm somewhat introverted, I think, but I enjoy the characters and the storylines. They become my friends, if you like, those are my companions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a relatively limited number of close friends. As I say, we live in a retirement community and tend to move in. We tend to have cliques of groups of 10, 12, 14 people. And I found out as I started to write that, yes, I tend to be a loner.
Mm-hmm.
I did try to break out of that. Coming from the UK, we were with another British couple one afternoon 12 years ago, and we said, we wonder if there's any other British people living in the area. So I put an advertisement in the local newspaper on what used to be one of our national holidays back in England, St. George's Day, April the 23rd. And I put an ad in the paper expecting I might get two or three responses, and 35 people showed up for free food and drinks. So that club is running pretty well. We got up to 75 members, and so and they're all in this retirement community.
Who would have thought that was a genius idea to do that? Offer some food and never know who's going to walk in, right?
Right, absolutely.
I like it. So you already told us what's next. You're working on the book Time and Again. And then is there anything, though, that we missed that you would like to talk about today?
I was reading something on your website, and it asked about books that you've read.
Yes.
And I've read quite a lot in this year. I reread The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood again. That's the third time I've read that. I also spent a good couple of weeks reading One Summer in America, 1927, by Bill Bryson, which is a prodigious book. I mean, he must have spent countless thousands of hours collecting together all the activity and incidents that happened in 1927.
Wow.
in America.
Mm-hmm.
I've read The Light, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, which I think is a marvelous book. That's about a blind girl, Marie Laurie, who escapes with her father, who is a curator of a museum in Paris. During World War II, they escaped to St. Malo. The next chapter is about Werner Fennig and his daughter in a coal mining complex near Essen in Germany. And he's a genius at electrical engineering and gets promoted up the ladder in the Wehrmacht, the German army. It's a very beautiful and lyrical novel told in the first person and present tense, which is a somewhat unusual combination.
Yes.
And the two principal characters move closer together as the novel progresses. But I think that's one of the best novels I've ever read, along with another favorite of mine, which I've now read five or six times, called The Bomber by Len Deighton, British author, who is probably best known for his cynical, semi-humorous spy stories. The Bomber's about a squadron of Lancaster bombers getting ready for a bombing raid in England. They're going to go over and bomb a city in Germany, and it all goes wrong because the fighter plane that's sent ahead to drop a flare on the factory that they want to bomb, and gets shot down prematurely, and it drops about 20 miles short, and all these Lancaster bombers set out and bomb the wrong place. They bomb this small town, and it's a story against war. It's an anti-war novel, really, what it is. I read Pride and Prejudice again for the third time, and I've also reread Presumed Innocent by Scott Drew, which remind me something of the piece I read about an unlucky break, about a lawyer who gets carried away with his attractive assistant lawyer that works with him. Most recently, I read The Book Thief by Marta Suzak. That's been on the hit list for New York Top 10 for 10 years, probably, I think. That, too, is a World War story, narrated by a character, Death, who describes how he has to lift all these dead souls up to heaven. Very lyrical story again, I thought. Mm-hmm. And the last book I read is called Sweet Sooth by Ian McEwan, published a couple of years ago.
Well, all of the reading that you do inspires your writing, and the one goes hand in hand. I really think that to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader.
Yes, and I've never been an enthusiastic reader of poetry, but I've been trying to educate myself reading poetry mm-hmm. recently.
Yeah.
You had a list of things that 21 things you should know about me. So I was scanning through that, and it keeps you up at night. What keeps me up at night, along with thinking of ideas for stories while in the bathroom, memories of actions and comments I wish I could retrieve. That's what probably bothers me if I can't get back to sleep. Things I shouldn't have said or things I shouldn't have done. And then another question was, what is the one thing you'll never do again? And that's intervene in someone else's marital dispute when asked to do so. did that about 30 years ago and was so sorry that I ever listened to the request to help out. It just made everything worse.
Oh, my gosh.
So they ended up hating me.
Yeah, well, go ahead and you could actually write the answers to those and we'll post them on the page on our website as well so that folks can really read and delve into that, too.
Okay.
Yeah, you learn to mind your own business, right?
Absolutely. Well, you think you're going to be helpful.
You know,
somebody says to you, I've got this problem with my husband. He won't open the door to me. He doesn't want to talk to me. Could you have a word with him? Well, that was the fatal move, saying, oh, yes, I could help.
I like it. You're funny.
I'm sure they ended up getting a divorce as a result.
Well, I don't think you were the catalyst, but it might not have helped, right?
Yeah. Another question you had was, what word do you misspell most often? And in my case, it's embarrassing with the two R's and two S's. I'm always having a problem with leaving one of the two R's
out.
Or the two S's.
Right.
That one pops up. And then you had yet another question, well, what's your favorite word? And I had to give a lot of thought to that and decided that the word love was my favorite. Mostly because years ago at someone's wedding ceremony, they read one of St. Paul's letters from the Gospel, and he wrote about love and saying, if I have faith so as to move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away everything I own and hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. And it goes on and on beyond that. But it stayed with me. And I always thought that was a wonderful thing. It's love that makes the world go round.
Absolutely.
Fix all the problems that we have.
Exactly. If people could keep that in mind, it's actually fairly simple. Wow, so much to know about you and share. And so if you will give us your website, and that way folks can find out more about you and where they can get their books.
MichaelESedgwick.com.
Okay. MichaelESedgwick.com. All right. So we'll head...
Sedgwick is spelled S-E-D-G... W-I-C-K. People automatically put an E after the G. So it's without an E. S-E-D-G-W-I-C-K.
Got it. MichaelESedgwick.com. And they can find out more about you. You are a fascinating person, and I was so looking forward to our conversation today. Thank you for taking the time to share you and your background and your books with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot, Patricia. It was very nice talking to you.